Thank you for tuning in. My name is Nella, and welcome to my podcast, Ethereality. Today's guest is Shauna Ristic. I have interviewed her a couple times now for other podcasts that I work on. Every time her and I come together, we connect on an amazingly deep level. So buckle up. But really quick, before we begin, hit that like button. And if you love near-death experience conversations, subscribe, join the family. All right, let's get into it. Thank you so much, Shauna, for being here today. I am super excited to hear about your near-death experience story and talk a little bit about how this has made an impact on you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Well, it was Christmas Day of 1993. Prior to that, I had graduated high school and got a job and then lost that job and was really needing to get some work and find a way to survive. And someone had offered me a position in a strip bar. And so being a model at the time, I was really comfortable with my body. And I was also sort of frustrated with where I was at with dating and men at the moment. So really at a place where I was exploring myself and my powers as a woman, and also a little fed up with going out and meeting guys that just sort of wanted to sleep with me and not really getting anything out of it. So I found that in the bar, I got a lot of my power back. I felt really empowered. I felt really strong, like, hey, you know, at least I'm getting paid for this. And worked there for about a year. And I thought that it was going to be an opportunity to make a good money and to be able to travel and go to go-sees and go to modeling gigs or try to get my modeling career set up. And after a while, you know, I got really kind of jaded. My opinion of men, the way they look at women, was really tanking. Then I go to work and these guys would throw all this money at me. And after a while, they started asking me to go on trips with them. And I really wasn't comfortable with it. But then I started thinking about it. And I was like, well, hey, you know, at least I'm getting something out of it. And that was how I rationalized the whole thing. So the first trip I was going to go on was to Georgia, to Atlanta. And that was kind of an up-and-coming hub for modeling at the time. And so I thought, well, I'll just go and I'll go to go-sees and I'll go meet some agencies and just see what I can stir up there. And I'll just hang out with this guy in the evening, totally on the up and up, told him no funny business, not crossing any boundaries, any lines here, just friendship. And he wanted company. That's what he said. He was bored and he was lonely and he just wanted company. So I go and it was fine at the beginning. And then like the second or third night, he calls me into his room. And then he made it really clear that he wanted more than what he could witness at the bar. And being a little afraid and not knowing what to do, and I kind of froze. He had the grace to realize that I really wasn't into that and said, you know, you don't want this, go back to your room. And I had negotiated before going that I get my own room, that, you know, I wasn't going to share a room with him, that everything was separate. And so I rushed back to my room and I was laying in the hotel room that night. I remember thinking about this. I'm like, you know, what am I doing? How far am I going to go with this? You know, I mean, am I going to just start becoming a high dollar call girl? I mean, what am I going to do here? What am I doing? And I really had a feeling that if I went down that route, if I crossed those sexual boundaries, that it would be soul damage and that it would be something that would really mark me from here on out. It would change everything. A lot of my relationships and especially a lot of my opinions about myself. Looking back, it probably would have been like years and years of therapy or something. So I'm laying in bed that night, though, really contemplating, because I had another trip lined up on Christmas Day with another customer. And I thought, well, how far am I going to go with that one? Because I can see, I know myself, and little by little, you know, you get pushed and pushed that I may cross those boundaries. And I fell asleep that night thinking about it. And I was also thinking about, like, well, let me just visualize what I want to have happen there. How do I want this trip to go? And I realized I couldn't visualize myself going to Minnesota. I was supposed to go to a Chiefs football game. I'd never even been to a football game. And I was supposed to fly to Minnesota to go to this Chiefs football game with this guy. And I thought, well, gosh, why can't I even see myself, you know, at this football game? And then I thought, well, can I even see myself driving to the airport? Let's just start at the beginning. I'm driving to the airport and I get to the airport. And I couldn't even see myself getting to the airport. I fell asleep thinking about all this, kind of contemplating how far am I going to go with this, and like, why can't I see myself getting to the airport, and what's going on with all this? And I woke up in the middle of the night and I sat up in bed and I said, oh my God, I'm going to be in a car wreck and it's gonna be a miracle if I make it. And at that point, I was like, oh, self-fulfilling prophecy. You don't want to, create that. Put that out of your mind. That's crazy. And I put it aside and went back to sleep. And then, the next day, we left, got home, and kind of forgot about that. And then fast forward to Christmas Day, I had been living with my parents because at that point I was trying to get out of the bar industry. I was wanting to figure something out, maybe go back to school, maybe do something, but try to make a change. But was making a lot of money and it was hard to make that change. And so I'd been living with my parents. Had just moved back in. And so on Christmas Day, I went downstairs to do the family Christmas. Santa Claus came and we opened up all the presents and, we had a little meal and all that stuff. And then my parents and my brother left to go to my extended family's house in another town. And I went back upstairs to take a nap. And before getting up to leave to see this guy or to go on this trip. And when I woke up, I had woke up late. And I had not packed my suitcase. So I remember I was just frantic and I packed everything and threw everything in my bag. And I remember why I packed what I packed. It's cold in Minnesota. Packed a lot of flannels and jumped in the car and took off towards the airport. I was living in a small town, Ottawa, Kansas. It's a teeny town of about 10,000 people. Flew through the downtown, got up on the highway, and was going about 75 miles an hour. I remember looking down at the speedometer, and at that point, I think 60 or 65 was the speed limit. Wasn't required to wear the seatbelt at that point either. It was a while ago. And I remember, though, that about a week or two before all this happened, I just had this intuition, you need to start wearing your seatbelt. So I had my seatbelt on, but I also had this old car phone. It was before cell phones. There were these big bag phones that like were in a sack that plugged into the cigarette lighter. And actually had like a receiver on them and everything. And I had one and it was in the passenger floorboard. And I remember thinking, okay, I need to take off my seatbelt and bend over and pick up this cell phone out of the floorboard so I can call this guy and let him know I'm on my way. And I was going over a bridge and I was passing a car. And I thought, well, let me just do that, before I do this adventure. And got over the bridge and was just about past the car and I took off the seatbelt. And I bent over to pick up the car phone. And as I sat up, I came close to hitting the car I was passing. And so I swerved to miss. And I think what happened was that I fishtailed. And I thought that I had stopped and kind of caught my wits about me and then continued on. I think that's probably what I intended to do. And then when I first woke up from the coma, that's what I thought I had done. But what had actually happened was that my car nosedived into the median, and then I flipped end over end across the median, which was about as wide as two lanes of the highway. And then I flipped end over end across the other two lanes of the highway, and they found me about 40 feet from the car, face down, turning blue. And miracle that happened was that the car behind me was a nurse, and the next car from the other direction was also a nurse. And so miraculously, two nurses on the scene immediately. And later they came to visit me in the hospital. I didn't remember that, but I did, after coming out of the coma, contact them and I sent them thank you cards for years after that at Christmas. And they had told me that it was like the Indy 500, and that basically there were people all over who had stopped and were picking up pages of my day planner. And it's funny because I called my day planner my life. Where's my life? And my life was scattered all over the highway, and people stopped to kind of pick up the pieces of my life or the pages of it. And then she just sort of tried to hold my airway open or stabilize me in some way until the ambulance came. And it just so happened that this day there was a trauma doctor who was at the Ransom Memorial Hospital in Ottawa, was there twice a month, and she happened to be there this month or that day. So they ambulanced me there instead of the extra 20 minutes or so it would have taken to go to Overland Park Medical Center, which I probably wouldn't have made it, they said. So she stabilized me as best she could, and then they life-flighted me to Kansas City, where I spent about a month in a coma in Research Medical Center at the hospital there, and then they transferred me to Meadowbrook Neurological Center in Gardner, where I spent another month. So that's kind of the nutshell on what happened on this side. I've sat and meditated with a lot of this as years have gone by, or especially shortly after it, just trying to remember things. And I do have some memories of the accident. I kind of remember getting out of body and just sort of watching from above and seeing everything being kind of white and hazy and kind of lots of smoky feeling about it. And I remember getting back into body and being in there and feeling like nothing works. It's lifeless. There's no point in this body. It's dead. There's nothing there. And then just kind of the shock of that getting out of body. And then the next real memories I have are, and these were some of the more immediate ones that came when I woke up, were waking up in this bright white room. It was really white lit, bright white lit. I mean, I suppose it could have been the hospital room, or an operating room. I don't know. I didn't see any apparatus. I didn't see any blinking things or any people. There were just six beings, three on either side of me, and they were really tall, bright white light beings. Kind of glowy, but they had forms of humans. They slid their hands underneath me and lifted me up out of my body. And then I was standing in the room with them, and they showed me what I'd done up to that point.
Like a life preview?
Yeah, I guess that's what we call that.
Yeah.
I don't remember a whole lot from the life review, except that I remember how things that I had done and said to other people, how that had made them feel, and feeling that myself. And a lot of, I guess you'd call it shame, even just regret for how I had made people feel, and recognizing that I didn't even know I was, that affects me to today. I'm always cautious, like, about how do I communicate with people, because I don't want to make them feel that way. But an acute awareness of how my actions had hurt others. And then they showed me what I'd come to do. And boy, do I wish I sure remembered that precisely now. But I did understand when I woke up from the coma that I had come here to help people heal and find their way back home, back to that truth that I was there knowing. I mean, the way that that room felt with them, and the way that these beings felt, was like real family, like home. Real home, not family with all the judgmental baggage or opinions that we have in this reality, but that everything was okay and that there was this general love and support. I guess you could say, like, all is forgiven, but it's like there was nothing to forgive. It's just, you're doing what you're doing the best you can. And they know that, just unconditional love. Then they showed me also what was possible from here on out. We could go forward, and what would happen if I chose to stay or if I chose to go? I mean, choosing to stay, I had the potential of helping people, but if I chose to go, they showed me how it would affect so many people. My brother and who he would marry, if he would marry, his relationship with women would be changed from here on out. I remember looking down at the hospital room from the corner at my body in the bed and seeing my mom sitting there, kind of holding my hands and with me, and just the feeling, I could just really feel how she was feeling, and realized, that there was so much pain and suffering. And prior to that, to a good friend of mine, I had said one night after working in the bar, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning at the coffee shop, and I was, fed up with everything. And I was like, I know I came here for a reason, but I reneged my contract. This place is really hard. This place is too hard. And people are horrible, the way they treat each other, and I don't want to do this anymore, whatever happens. And people will be hurt, and they'll get over it. They'll get over it. And then there, looking at my mom, I realized people don't get over that. You don't get over those kind of things.
Nope.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're like making me cry because you mentioned your brother and your mom. And my brother and my mom are the closest people to me out of anyone on the planet. And so I'm just like putting myself in your shoes, just like I could not choose to go knowing how that would impact my mom and my brother.
Exactly. The way I like to explain it is, like, it's all connected, and that the impact of me leaving, and not just me, but any of us leaving, creates ripples throughout the, I call it the matrix, or throughout the grid. Say it's like looking out of an airplane at night over a city, and how all the lights are there, and each of us is like a light, and it's all kind of connected in this hidden connection. But if one light goes out, you can create a power surge that, like, dims all the lights around it.
Like
And
a Christmas light strand that doesn't work when you take one of the bulbs out.
yeah, that's a really great analogy too. Totally. seeing that and understanding that, and even after the coma, my mom had saved like all the letters and all the cards I'd gotten, and I had hundreds and hundreds of hundreds of prayergrams from people from churches that had heard about my accident and that had written all these prayers for me and mailed them to my family. People I didn't even know, and I just like, wow, it does. It creates a ripple. We're all so connected. And the impact of each of our vibration, of each of our essence, of each of our existence impacts so many people that we're so unaware of. And so I understood that there. Nevertheless, it was really nice there. I wasn't sure I wanted to come back. And then the last thing I really remember is the council, as I've come to call them, is being in a circle of them, and there were like 12 of them, and I was amongst them seated, but I couldn't say anything. I just was waiting for them to decide what I was going to do. And they were debating whether I should go or stay, or should we send in someone else in my place, kind of like a walk-in thing, or should we just scrap the whole thing, or what were we doing? And then I have a few memories of starting to come back in the body. One time I remember waking up and seeing my friend there. So they only let people come in like two people at a time for 30 minutes once or twice a day. And at this point, he was in there and he was sitting there in the chair and kind of dozing. And I woke up and saw him and I was like, I was trying to will him awake and will him awake. And then he did. He woke up and he was like, oh, Johnny, you're awake. And I tried to ask him what happened, and in the accident, I forgot to tell you all the things that happened to me physically. So I broke six ribs, four front and back, punctured my lung. I broke my chin off. I have metal plates in my face here. I had head injuries. I broke the ankle, fractured my pelvis, probably other stuff that I always forget. So I couldn't talk because of all the damage that had been done to my face. But he understood I wanted to know what had happened. So he starts telling me, but I don't remember really what he said, but I remember the way it felt. And I remember the feeling in the room. And it was like that love space that I knew on the other side, that pregnant potential love was there too. It's here. It's like the foundation of everything. It just sort of makes everything. It's the genesis of what all we are, and it's also the genesis of what motivates us and what moves us. It's like the water that the fish are swimming in, and that's everything. And I could feel it and I could see it. And I was astounded. I was, it's here. It's here. And I think that fast forward to later, one of my biggest searches has always been, I know it's here. Where is it? Where is it? Because I also know that we have this illusion where we just forget who we are, and we get so wrapped up in the daily stuff that we forget what it's all about. But right then and there, I knew it was all about love, and everything was love. And I could look at him and I could see in his eyes that light, just like the light beings I saw on the other side, that was in him and it's in each person. And you can see it in people, you can see it in their eyes, that there's this spark, this light that's in there, this essence. And that too is that love, that is that same essence as the fabric we're all swimming in and we're all a part of. And so I could see all this in him. And then, coming into body after being out is not easy. I applaud every single one of you who's out there and still in your body. It's not an easy thing to do. And so I couldn't really hold it any longer. I was trying to stay conscious and I just sort of let go and fell back. And it's like, just kind of fall back into the darkness. And that space is hard to explain to people because it's like falling back, but it's like being suspended at the same time. And years later, I was in a hypnotherapy session. In this session, I wanted to know where I was from. And I blasted through the universe, through all these stars and all of this amazing wormholes and black holes. I mean, who makes this stuff up? You can't make this stuff up. It just happened in the session. But I remember in the session, I came to this planet, this bright white light planet, and this energy, this voice came up into the space in front of me and it started speaking. And I remember at that moment going, wow, I know you. You're the voice I heard in the coma. You're the one who spoke to me. And at that moment, I wanted to try to go closer, and then I couldn't. Then I started falling backward, and it's like falling into space and being suspended backward, like something is also drawing you back. And I remember going back through the wormholes and through the black holes and through space and stars and all of that universal energy, and then coming back into the room. And then there I was back in the body in that hypnotherapy session. But it was a real eye-opening experience to remember at that point what that voice was like, and that there was this thing speaking to me.
Do you remember what it said?
I don't.
Oh.
That's the thing, is it's like it all happens telepathically, and it's usually telling me things like, you're okay. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing. Don't spin about this. Don't make it so hard. You're okay. And we're here, and we're with you. Yeah. And then your mind jumps in with like, what the heck is this? This doesn't make sense. Who is this? What is that? Can I go on that planet? And then you hear your own thoughts over what you're actually hearing, and it kind of erases things. It's kind of a bummer. It kind of happens to us when we get born too. Kind of part about being on this planet, you just forget it all. So during the NDE part, in the circle of these beings, and then kind of coming back and then seeing Patrick, my friend, as I woke up. And then the last really memory I have of coming back into body is them wheeling me in a wheelchair down the hallway of the hospital. I remember being in the body and kind of looking around at things. And I remember seeing someone coming in a wheelchair towards us and thinking, holy cow, that lady, she is messed up. As we got closer and closer and closer, and then I realized it was a mirror. And then I got really freaked out and just got right back out of body. And then the next thing I really remember is the ambulance ride to the neurological hospital, Meadowbrook. Once they moved me there, they had these really neat machines that are like in a human-sized sardine can with really bubbly warm water in it. And I hadn't been able to take a bath. And that was kind of my go-to for self-care before that. I hadn't been able to take a bath for, well, since this had happened, because I had too many tubes and wires out of my whole body that there was no way to do anything but a sponge bath. Or my mom to beg them to let her wash my hair over a, pan, which I don't remember at all. They strap you into this chair and then they lift you up and then they turn you over and then they settle you down in the sardine can. And it was the first time I was in water. And at that point, things started coming back and my body started awakening up. And I started coming back into body. And there were a lot of things I didn't remember, about my life and about my past. But once people told me about it or reminded me, this is how you hold a fork and this is how you feed yourself. Once people reminded me of those things, I came back pretty quickly. And at the neurological hospital, they had told my parents that it would be 4 to 6 months before I could get out of there and get home, and that they should really expect me not to be able to live on my own, not to ever go back to school, probably not to hold a job, probably always need assistance and be mentally handicapped. But in reality, I did it in 4 weeks and got out. I still had to have some surgeries on my ankle and some surgeries on some teeth. Got out in February, and by August, I was living on my own again and driving again and went back to school. From that point on, it's a whole process in getting to know the council on this side and figuring out how to make this life thing work, because I had clearly messed it up before. And so I, spent a lot of time going, what are all these other humans doing? What are they wanting? Because they, okay, you need a job, you need a car, you need a significant other, and you need a place to live. You can get all those things, you're supposed to be happy. And then I had all those things after a couple of years, and I wasn't happy. And I was like going through a big depression and thinking suicidal thoughts, and like, well, that doesn't make sense. I'm definitely not going to off myself after all I've been through. That would be a real slap in the face of my family and other people. And so I had started journaling because I had been looking for a way to sort of get all this out of my system, this emotions and all of this impact. I mean, coming back after something like that is like every filter you had is gone. I mean, my social etiquette, it still struggles with it, but it was totally off. I'd say things just because it hurt to keep things in. It hurt to try to hide things or to be secrets or to lie. It's so painful. And at the same time, I was so sensitive to energy and to the emotional charge in things. I could feel things so fully. There was no more filters. Cuss words were so painful. Just the way people would throw those at each other, and it would just be like daggers in me. It's still that way, but I've learned how to buffer up against it after 30 years of this, because my 30-year anniversary last Christmas. But so I buffered up against it a lot now. But at the beginning, it was so painful and so hard to be around anything that was the harshness and the anger. And I would spend hours just sobbing for what we do to each other. I mean, war is the dumbest thing. It doesn't solve anything, you know? And then that war, I call it dehumanizing harshness. It's that energy of dehumanizing harshness where we're so harsh to another as though they're not even another human being, not even another spiritual being. You know, that's what cuss words can sometimes feel like, or that anger that comes out, or we do that to each other. And the way that that feels in the body is so painful to me. And I would just sob for hours about the state of the world and just thought, you know, I can't do this. I can't do this. It's too hard here, the way that people are, which is kind of where I was before the whole thing happened. And then I started journaling about that. And I just started writing and free writing and just letting it out and letting it out. And I just needed to get the pen flowing. And then I'd let whatever came out come out. And then just write whatever came in my mind. And after a while, I just kind of go into a trance and just whatever was coming out and writing and writing and writing and trying to get my pen to go and trying not to get my head like it does when that voice came up to speak to start analyzing and what are you writing? Wait, that doesn't make sense. That's not how you spell that. You know, getting out of the way. Getting out of the way is the hardest thing. And but when I'd go back and read it, I'd start noticing that something started answering me. And that's where I started communicating with the council from this side. And for years, pretty much that was it, is that I would just confide in them in my struggles here, and they would guide me and help me understand what was going on and what I was doing. And, you know, and then after a while, or after about a year or two, I was still really unhappy. I had all those things I was supposed to want, you know, the job, the car, the boyfriend, the home. And I'm not happy. Why? And my boyfriend at the time had done a trade with a massage therapist who was going to teach him how to do massage. And she had agreed to teach him some techniques, and I was going to be the guinea pig. And then we did one session, and it was really the first time I'd ever had that kind of therapeutic touch. And it really evoked a lot in me. Then we never could organize a time to set it back together. So she gave us one session, and he gave it to me because I was the stressed out one. And I went to her and I was like, you know, Maloa, I have everything I'm supposed to want here, and I'm miserable, and I don't know why after all I've been through. And she said to me, well, maybe you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing. And I said, well, what am I supposed to be doing? And she said, have you thought about checking out this massage school? So I was like, oh, I'm game for whatever. And so I went there, and as soon as I walked into the massage place, I knew this is it. This is where I'm supposed to be. And that started my journey as a healer. And did that for a couple years, my training, and then graduated and moved to another town and found a little office in an herb shop and was determined to go back to college to get my bachelor's. Got accepted into the honors program. Not bad for someone who's not supposed to be able to go to school, and 2 years the rest of my bachelor's degree, and started my practice as a massage therapist. And then the council started communicating me with me in session. A lot of times I kind of go into trance. They just tell me stuff sometimes. Tell them about this, or tell them this story, or ask them about this. And usually I'd argue with it because there's that mind that's like, this doesn't make sense. I can't say that. They'd be so insistent that finally I'd have to just blurt it out. And then this miraculous healing would happen with this person. And so that continued like that for a number of years. A lot of things happened in that time period. I didn't really talk about that part. I found that most of the people, I was in Kansas and in the Midwest, could either take in the miraculous healing part, you know, the physical healing I had of my story, or they could take in it, maybe some of the spiritual component if I made it more of a religious bit. But they couldn't really understand me communicating with guides, journaling, and them telling me these things. So I didn't really talk about that part. But little by little, that's pretty much what people came for. And so I did that for about 10, 15 years. And then spirit said, it's time for you to meet your husband's spiritual teacher. And whenever that happens, it's the right time. And through a bunch of serendipity and a long story, we ended up in Santa Cruz, California through that endeavor. Got in touch with the International Association of Near-Death Studies here, and people wanted to hear my story and started talking about it. And it was the first time I talked about it. And it's been a long haul. I didn't have language for it for a long time. I didn't have language for the intuitive part I do in my practice, but now that's pretty much mostly what I do, and you can find me still doing it online and in person.
If you're getting any value out of this podcast, please hit that like button and subscribe. Also, if you've enjoyed my content before, or maybe you're new here but you like it, drop a comment and let me know you're here. I would love to get to know my audience. Thank you for listening, and let's get back to the content. That's quite the journey. And I'm so glad that it came to this point where you had found your niche, you know, like your place in life where you can feel that purpose.
Yeah, you know, after the NDE, there really wasn't a way around that.
I know,
I mean,
right?
it's like it's so strong in you that you have to go towards it. And if it's something that doesn't resonate with you, it totally shuts you down and contracts you and pushes you away. You just can't do it. There was a period of time in that 15-year span I just kind of blew through where I lived 4 years in France. And one technique that they taught me in France was how to follow the brightest path. The streets in France and in the Mediterranean were set up like these kind of spirally lose yourself, medieval streets, little small streets, and they're not like the grids that they're set up in the Midwest where everything is north, south, east, and west, and easy to find yourself if you get lost. So I'd go out in the evenings and I'd wander the streets of the town and purposely get myself lost wandering around. And then I'd try to find my way back to my apartment. And what I discovered is that if I always followed the brightest path, not necessarily the most well lit, but the one that felt the most open, that made me feel drawn to it, that expanded me, that made me feel the most uplifted, that would always lead me back to my home. And that became a metaphor for life, is if you follow the brightest path, you'll always find your way home. And it's knowing how to know what the brightest path is. And as I moved to California and people wanted me to start teaching them to do what I do, I, through the help of the guides, developed this sort of understanding that, or defining what it is that brightest path feels like. And it's that which, when you're centered in your core, it opens you, it expands you, it lightens you, it draws you to it. There's usually like a warmth to it. Whereas if it's not for you and it doesn't resonate with you, it kind of contracts you or closes you down or sort of shuts you down or gets cold or pushes you back. And if you can notice in your heart of hearts that which opens and expands you, it will always draw you to the right place. That was a huge learning curve for me.
That's something that made an impact on me too when I first talked to you, is I've turned that into a practice in my life too, gauging what feels expansive versus contractive.
Yeah, it works. It works. It gets a little complicated because sometimes it can be confusing, when we feel so congested, for instance, because, most of us are empaths. We all talk about empaths are ones who feel other people's emotions as if they're their own. And maybe it's just me because of who I work with and the people that I work with. Maybe they're mostly empaths, but I'm of the opinion that we are all mostly very deep feelers in this planet. We've just been taught to shut it down, or that there's a large number of us empaths out there. And we tend to be taught to go into our mind, just like I was talking about, and analyze and argue or self-edit or try to shut down the information or quiet it, or no one's going to believe me, or we need to keep it down there, or, I can't talk about that. I mean, that was sort of my journey in this whole thing, was that I can't say those things because people are going to think I'm crazy and they're going to probably institutionalize me or something, And so we shut all that down and then we just move into our mind and we sort of analyze and think that that's the way to go, that we have to think our way out of it. But all that does is create mind spin and we just get sort of lost in our thoughts and get confused. But if we just settle into the body and into the core channel and into the true self, Then you get the answers, and then you can notice what opened you. It's just that as an empath, we also tend to pick up other people's stuff, call it OPS, other people's stuff. When we're so used to feeling what other people feel, if you're not clear that it's yours or not yours, then we tend to either judge ourselves for feeling that way, and own it as our own self, or we judge that other person. Why are they making me feel that way? And project it out. And either way, it's a projection, either into yourself or a projection out. And neither of that is helping you be really honest with how it's affecting you. But if instead you're really clear with where you are and what you feel like in body, then once you have that clarity, you'll notice something come and shift it. And you don't have to be like, ooh, I feel like crying all of a sudden. What's wrong with me? Or, ooh, I feel like crying. What did that person just, what did they do? Instead, you can get real curious and be like, wow, I was fine. And then this person came into my field and I feel like crying. And, huh, isn't that curious? Maybe that's just how our energies interact. And how do I really want to be with that energy? And what do I, and then you can get curious and get about the energy and get all sorts of information about that and be more clear about how to do it. And it's also useful from time to time to set the intention to let go of everything that's not you and yours, just because that gets congested too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important to be able to make that distinction between an energy that is external versus internal. And I feel like if we're not mindful of that energy being external, that we are sort of, due to our lack of awareness, we assume and we take on those external energies and think that it's our experience.
Or something is going on with us, exactly, and it's not at all. It could be that we're picking up someone else's experience, or it could be that they're having a rough day, or it could be ours. But what happens is that you'll pick up that experience from them, and it may have a match with something you have experienced in your own life, and then your mind's going to go right into that whole trauma that you experienced, and then freshen that up, and then make it yours,
Well, yeah,
right?
and they have scientific evidence now that shows that we all have this like electromagnetic field around us.
Totally, totally.
I mean, if somebody thinks that maybe that sounds woo-woo or whatever, like there's evidence that shows that that exists and that it has an impact on, like vibes are real.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you can detect EMF frequencies off a human body. You can detect light from a human body. I read an article about a moo room, MU, moo room. I believe it was at Stanford. This was a long time I read this article. It was a room they had tried to create where there was no electromagnetic energy in it, like a vacuum, but they could put a person in there. They even found with a person there would still be EMF coming off of their body once they put them in there.
See, scientific evidence.
Exactly,
So
exactly.
I did want to ask a question about when you were experiencing the beings. You said there were six, three on each side, and they sort of lifted you out of your body. And then you were standing in this room and there with these beings, right? What did that transition? Because you went from there to then talking about the 12. What did like six more come in? What did that look like?
I don't remember like all the gaps between the standing with them and then being in the council in the circle. They were kind of like two separate experiences. It wasn't like it happened all at once. Those are kind of two separate memories. But the six of them felt like family that were sort of holding me there. And then when I was later in the circle with the 12, it felt like they were family, but it didn't feel as close a family as those six did. It didn't feel like they were my tribe, kind of like they were your boss, or something like that. Like they're wiser and higher instances involved that were coming in to determine whether this mission or whatever needed to continue or not. It's a good question because I haven't really teased this out before, but like the six felt really close. I've kind of called them, when I work with people, the tribe. I call them my council, but I've learned to call them my tribe. And they've explained to me that it's kind of like, if you can imagine for conceptual terms, that we each are like on our own planet, and we have a place where everybody on that planet is very similar to us and has a similar vibration and this loving, open, light-filled vibration. And that when we choose in our consciousness to travel through space-time and come and inhabit this planet, that there's a group of beings that agree to join you on that journey, but they aren't going to incarnate. They kind of stay around you and help you on your path. And they're the ones who help you with all the serendipities that happen, you know, throw pennies heads up in your way, show up some numbers that are in alignment, give you little signs on the way. They're kind of like they're your tribe that are here to help you. But what I find is that for most of us, they are so close to us that we don't feel them separate from ourselves. And so I always kind of play with it, like ask them to step way, 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 way back so that you feel yourself without them, and then draw them back in and just see what that feels like and play with it. So the six kind of felt like they were my tribe, the ones who were sort of, you know, with me on this journey. It's interesting. I hadn't really thought about it like this, but yeah. And the rest of them felt like they were kind of like beings that also had their hands in other things. Like maybe the council members a step up that also had, you know, other people or other lives that they were involved in, whereas the six felt like it was sort of here with me. That's
I
interesting.
like that explanation. Yeah, that makes sense. Because I was thinking about when you were talking about it, the fact that a lot of people create this distinctions between souls and angels.
There's that feel to it. You know, many people that I've talked to this about this concept too. I've said, oh, it's like your soul family. So I think the concept of a soul family is out there, and that people know about that. And I would say that the six of them were definitely soul family. And
The tribe, yeah.
yeah. But then on the larger scale, it might be fair to say that there was an angelic component to them. I mean, when I check in with that, there's a yes to it.
I love
And
that.
you know, you actually this is something I don't share very often because I've never really known how to fit this into anything but woo-woo weirdness, an experience I had. But when I was in massage school, I was very pragmatic and very much this has to be anatomy, physiology, I'm in my office, and very rational and fixing bodies. And I didn't know any of the woo-woo stuff, despite journaling in my free time. And then someone came to me and said, hey, I heard about this woman who's doing angel readings. And I'm like, what's that? I've never heard of angel readings. That sounds really interesting. Not a character for me at that point, but I really, something in me was like, oh, go have a session with her. And when I went to have a session with her, I remember she said to me when I got there, you know, I was checking in before you got here with the angels, and she worked with a group of seraphim angels and channeled them. And she, according to her, was an angel incarnate. And I was like, okay, I don't know what that means. I don't know how to take that in. But okay. She had said, oh, that when she checked in with them about who I was, all they would say is an old friend returns. And she said, you know, they've been telling me that an apprentice is coming and would you like to be my apprentice? And okay. So for a year or two, I would go to her house every week or so, and she taught me how to meditate. She taught me how to connect in. She taught me how to clear energy. A lot of other things that I don't even, I think just sort of integrated in. I don't remember distinctly. But I worked with her for a couple of years. And then flash forward to after massage school, going to Kansas University, as I mentioned, getting my degree. At that point, there was one night when I was driving back to Kansas City. I was living in Kansas City at this point and commuting daily to Lawrence, Kansas, to the university. I was driving back to Kansas City that evening, and I thought, oh, I just really need to just clear my head. And I like to drive at night. And let me just drive downtown and look at the lights of the city. And then something told me, get off here, you know. And I ended up in a part of a city that was kind of a seedy part of city. Not very safe for me to be in alone as a woman at night. But there I was. And I knew this part because I had actually done some modeling down there and had worked with a photographer in this area. And so I was like, why am I down here? And then I was sitting at a stop sign or a stoplight or a stop. And suddenly this bright white light just blasted me open. And I was sitting there, and it's like those things that happened, like when that voice came, it happened so fast and so telepathically and instantaneously. And I could just see instantly how every person who came into my life had come for a reason. And it's like you put up there what you need, and it goes up into the grid, and then it matches up with people, and then they come in to line up and to have messages for you. And some people come in for long periods, and some people are brief, but then everything lines up for a reason. And every single person who had come into my life was part of it. And I'm it's so beautiful, and I'm just sobbing, and I'm just tears are running down my face. And as I'm coming out of it, I'm like, what the heck was that? And then my mind starts to kick back in, and it's like, you're crazy. What the heck just happened to you? Oh my God, oh my God, who's around? Anybody see you? Where are you? You're sitting at the stop sign or stoplight, and you're crying and sobbing, and like, who's nobody saw that, right? And nobody's gonna arrest me for sitting here crying, are they? But I grabbed onto the last piece of that memory because I knew I was going to forget it, because that's what happens when the mind kicks back in. And all I could grab on was to that one woman that had the angel things of how important that she was to my journey. And then fast forward a few months, and I kept feeling like spirit was like, hey, I got something to tell you. Knock, knock, knock. Hello. And I was like, oh, usually I'm like, la, 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 I can't hear you. I'm too busy. And finally, I was okay. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to listen. CJ, this woman, her name is CJ Martis, she had told me that part of what she had come to do was to help reunite a bunch of other angels on the planet who would also come and incarnate, because angels don't usually incarnate, but she had come to help with that. So here we are, flash forward, and spirit's telling me they got to talk to me. And I finally sit down to meditate. I'm like, okay, fine, I'll listen. What is it? What is it? What is it? What is it? And nothing's coming because I'm just trying to. An
Force
angel
it.
force it. And I finally just fall back on my back on the floor, and I'm like, what? And I kind of let go. And then just another download of light came. I saw that I was one of those that she was trying to find. And I don't know if I even want you to put this on because I'm a little bit intimidated. But, you know, and as I had this experience, just that flash of information and knowing and that intuitive thing that happens, and I was like, what? What do you do with that information? Hey, I think you might be part of that angel incarnate thing. That just seemed way too far out there for me as my little human insignificant self to take in. But I got up after that because I knew my mind, and I knew it was going to edit all that out and forget all about that. And I called her immediately, and I was like, listen, this is what just happened, and I need your confirmation, or I need to know if this is right. And she said, well, let me check in. And she did her thing, and she comes back and she's like, yeah, it's right. And I never have known what to do with that information. But your question saying, who was it in the council, and making me have to really look at who is the 12 beings there, not just the six and then there's 12, but like, who are those other six? You know, it's like, yeah, they felt like they were of that higher order or higher, whatever it was, graduated class, whatever you want to call that, that could really be part of that angelic realm. You know, and me as a soul with the soul family who is also here, I always felt like I was here representing the council, but they also always were telling me, you're one of us, you're one of us, you're one of us. And I, for a long time, couldn't even take that in. I was like, what do you mean? You guys are these magnificent light beings, these amazing, you know, non-judgmental, love-filled beings. How can I be that? And what I've come to understand is that all of us are that at the essence. It's just that we forget about it because we're also humans, you know, and we do all of our dumb human stuff, and we're here in bodies with these minds that like to hijack everything. I know mine does. It's always like, don't listen to that. That's crazy. You know, you're gonna get people aren't gonna listen to you. They're gonna think you're weird, and you know, and then you're gonna then everything's gonna fall apart. You know, my mind's always busy doing that. You know, I mean, all of us do that, right? We self-edit.
I can relate in the sense that ever since I was a child, I had this underlying sense that I had a scary, overwhelming purpose that was going to
Why?
be really big. Like it was going to
Yes.
positively impact a lot of people. I developed some pretty strange angles as a teenager of what that might look like. And I mean, growing up, it was overwhelming, the thought of that, you know? So I suppressed it as much as I could.
I had that
And
feeling too, not in the same way, but yeah, that I'm supposed to be helping big numbers of people.
yeah, like influencing. And that was like before the concept of influencer, you know?
Right.
But I had this awareness that I was going to influence a lot of people, and that was a lot. That was a
And
lot to
here you are. Yeah.
carry.
But you know what's so beautiful about it? I mean, mine was more that I was supposed to help large numbers of people to heal and find their way home. You know, because there were a lot of people who got stuck here on the planet and who forgot who they are. And then they just keep in this cycle of birth, death, rebirth, samsara, because they'd forgotten. And, you know, to wake them up. So let's team up.
I know,
But
right? It's just wild because a lot of people would look at that as delusion, you know, like you have a delusion of grandeur.
exactly. Or, who do you think you are? You think you're so great. What makes you so special? That's
Right.
what I got a lot of. Yeah.
Yeah, I haven't got any feedback because I haven't really told anyone. There's you and then my friend David. I had an interview with, recently. I'm starting to talk about it. Not too long ago, my brother and I were having a conversation about it, and I actually told the very first soul about, well, it wasn't even just me telling someone, it was also just me finally connecting some dots. And I was just like, oh, wow. Just there has been so many hints dropped my entire life that this was going to be in my life, that this was part of the plan, talking
And
about these
the funny
things.
thing is that no matter what we think about it, what we envision, and what we think we're going to do or whatever, or how much we hold it back, it ends up manifesting anyway.
Right,
Here you
right.
are.
That's so wild.
That's my goal, is to try to reach more people. I realize there's only so much of me and so many hours in a day, and I do enjoy the work I do one-on-one with people. I mean, I work one-on-one via Zoom, via phone, or in person, but now my endeavors are trying to reach out and to work with more groups of people and find ways to work with larger audiences so I can impact more lives and help wake up more people in some way, shape, or form, however that's supposed to happen. Be in more of service,
Good. Yeah. I love that. That's not a question that we can answer about angels versus souls, if angels incarnate or not, or I mean, we have our theories. We can gauge what feels expansive or what we perceive, but
have all sorts of big books that have, evolved over the millennia that tell us what one person's perspective of the truth is,
yeah, exactly. And I do find it still quite fascinating. Like, I feel like angels aren't restricted to their dimension either. Like, I've talked to a lot of people who have told me about angel encounters, and they've been like, they literally vanished. They were nowhere to be found. We walked out the door a few seconds after them. There was nowhere they could have hidden. We walked out the door and they were just gone. It's just like, how does that happen, unless they're able to like materialize and dematerialize in order to like interact with us and to give us messages, to be that catalyst for certain
Totally.
experiences or thought processes, and then
Yeah.
they just psh.
Away. Yeah. And maybe they do incarnate, I mean,
Maybe they do. Maybe they have.
maybe they are, right?
Maybe they were talking.
Exactly. Exactly.
Who
Yeah. It's a big lofty thing to try to wear,
Yeah.
But I do remember one time, this is a sweet story. One time after I had this experience, I was trying to take it in, and I remember sitting at a McDonald's in Wichita, Kansas, and I was waiting for a friend who was going to meet me there. So I'm just sitting on the booth, and I was like, what do I do with this angel idea? And I thought, well, what would it feel like if I just took it on and wore it, And I remember sitting there and going, okay, let me just incarnate that and let's be that. And what would it feel like if I had wings? And I was just kind of playing with the idea of like letting my wings unfold. And this little girl was sitting across from me. She looks at me. She comes up to me. She says, "Can I sit next to you?" And I was like, "Sure." So she sat down next to me. We just sat there, waited for her family, and it was a little bit weird. I was like, now I kind of feel a little uncomfortable. You saw my wings. But it was such an interesting confirmation, because children see.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they have that sensitivity. I love that so much. I'm trying to figure out what to do with this information.
It's okay. You can put it out
Are
there.
you sure?
It's kind of wacky. Yeah, just do what you feels right.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point in my career, things are going well. I'm helping a lot of people, and I'm so grateful for the lives that I'm able to touch. I mean, it means the world to me, and I'm so glad for them in the processes that they go through. I want to reach more people. I don't know how to do it because there's only one of me and there's only so many hours in a day, and I do need to support my family, and all that money thing has to become an issue. If this allows me and helps me to find a way to reach more people, hey, so be it. I don't know how that's going to happen or what's going to happen or how to work in larger audiences. I just invested in my business, with this program called Thought Leader, and to try to move into offering more group sessions with people and trying to transform my business in that way, doing more group work and then do more speaking engagements on stages and things. We'll see how that unfolds. That's one effort I was trying to make in order to reach more people. But if this is what happens and this is part of it, then so be it. At this point, I kind of recognize the spirit has more control over things than I do. And that as we were talking about this, I couldn't help but just feeling it want to come forward and this want to be spoken and expressed. And that's what needs to happen. And it's some people will always think we're weird. And some people aren't ready to hear certain information. Some people are. And some people, it will help them on their path to realize who they are. I had a friend recently tell me something that was really profound for me. He said that he likes to see the world as though he's God. And I remember thinking, well, that sounds like blasphemy. I mean, like, who do you think you are? But then I kind of tried that on for a moment. I was just like, what happens if you look through the eyes? And I was like, we all think it'd be arrogant and sort of like, oh, I'm God, her, like Zeus or something, but it's not at all. It's very loving, it's very compassionate. All you really want is the best for people. That's all you really want. I just want people to heal. I just want people to find their way home. I just want people to realize who they are. And there's a lot of energies on the planet that have tried to keep us really small and make us believe that we are these dumb humans who are insignificant, and it is such a lie. And if one person can remember that they are the light, they are the light of this world, and that they matter and that they contribute to the goodness on this planet, then yay.
Yeah, and it's like if you're hearing this and feel like that is not a concept that you've really adopted for yourself, just try it on.
Right,
Just try it
exactly.
on for a little while,
Yeah. What does
Maybe.
it feel like if you pretended you were the angel and spread out your wings, right? Like,
Yeah.
how would it feel to look at the world that way? Because our ego mind wants to think, oh, that's so arrogant. It's so blah, 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 blah. That's just that energy that's been trying to keep you small and making you convince yourself that you don't matter.
Yep.
And it's a lie. And if more of us recognize the light and the love that we are and the beauty that we are, we wouldn't need to go do all this stupid war stuff. We'd actually do love instead.
And that's the goal.
Right. Yeah. Like Marianne Williamson says, we would have a ministry of peace rather than a ministry of war.
Cannot tell you the depths of my soul that is resonating with this statement. Like, that is the goal.
Yeah. To be that love. That's what we came here to do, is to feel love and body. You can only feel it and experience it the way you can on this planet in this life, as a human, right? The way that we can physically feel love, the way that we can move our bodies, you don't get that anywhere else, right? Not in the same way. And that's what we came to do. Get in.
Yes.
More of us recognized it, it would be such a different planet. But instead, what's happened is that those energies that want to keep us small and focus on the darkness, which has been even a method of healing up to this point, focus on what's right, focus on what's contracted, and try to expand it out. That is one method of healing. But there's also the method of, hey, what's already working? Where's the light flowing? What's already expanded? And let's focus on that and bring more of that. Let's bring more light and more expansion and more love. Follow the brightest path. Let's do that instead of always digging in the contraction, trying to make things smaller and tighter, right? And we do that to ourselves.
What's interesting about that is that growing up, I was often compared to one of my siblings, and I could never be my sibling. I was me, and no matter how hard I tried, I could never be her. That led to this obsession with trying to like better myself internally, because externally I couldn't do it, obviously. So I moved to that internal, and I became so hyper-focused with becoming a better version of myself, for facing and understanding aspects of the deep inner core of my psyche, of my personality. At a very young age, I started that journey. And I started to realize into my young adulthood in like mid-20s that I had become addicted to the like shadow work,
Yeah,
essentially. And
most of us do it. You know, we get on this healer's this healing path, and then we forget that at some point, aren't we healed?
right, can't
At
we
some
just
point,
like sit here and
are you not
enjoy
broken?
where we're at?
Right. And you know, I mean, that was useful. What you came into that family to experience. You know, that experience propelled you to want to dive deeper into who the truth of who you are. You
Yes.
know, but the unfortunate part was that the seed of that was that you're insignificant. You don't matter, and that's what needs to be realized, that that seed is the lie, right? And that once you can see that and see, you know, whoa, I do matter, and that not I matter like arrogantly, but you know, I'm important here, my light matters and it shines here, and that I have something to do here and to contribute to this place. You know, once we can own that and finally be that, then it all changes, right? And then you're more whole than broken. Because at some point we have to acknowledge that. How much self-work do you need before you're actually whole? Self-work is good, you know. I mean, I'm still learning things about myself where I'm like, huh, I'm repeating a childhood pattern, aren't I? You know, but I also recognize that the truth of me isn't that broken one at all.
Like, if things were going well, like if I had done work and I was experiencing the fruits of my labor, you know, and I was happy and enjoying life, like I would have to create issues so that I could keep working on myself. And that, and I was very good at finding them,
Right.
finding the issues. And it's interesting because you get to a certain point.
Damn, there's no more issues.
No, it's not that there's no more issues. It's just that, like you had said, once you have that realization of like, I am worthy, I am of value, I wasn't insignificant ever, that this path is my path, not my sister's, you know? Once you realize that, like that whole drive to like make problems to solve, to be addicted to that growth journey, to like sort of fight myself,
Yeah.
it goes away.
Right. You're right. It's that whole desire to self-edit and make yourself small suddenly doesn't even make sense anymore.
Yeah, once you take on the idea that we matter, that
Yeah.
we're here for a reason, and that all of that needed to happen in order to propel us to where we
Yeah.
are today,
Exactly.
to make the impact that we're here to make.
Exactly. Do what you came to do. You know, when I first started this journey of talking about my near-death experience, it was through this project in Santa Cruz that was trying to get off the ground and actually ended up collapsing. But through it, I met Raymond Moody and his wife, Cheryl. And she was the one who introduced the concept of editing to me because she was like, quit self-editing, quit self-editing. The whole idea that we shut ourselves down because we're nervous about how other people can take us in. And it seems like the most ridiculous thing that we do.
Well, that's the ego. You
Yeah,
know,
it's
that's
it
the
also
masking, trying to fit a certain mold or expectation.
yeah, it's also fear. At that time, you know, they were encouraging me to write a book, and I still haven't had time to sit down and do that. So instead, I do podcasts and talk to people and do my business. The working title for my book was Owning Who You Are. And I think that's really what it comes down to, is really owning who you are. And whether that's angelic or a light being or Christian or Jewish or however you label it, the truth is that it's really about love. And it's really about bringing love to the planet. And it's really about just channeling that energy out there. And the more we can do that, the more we can own that that's our mission. That's why my business advisor said when I start getting my, what do you call that? Imposter syndrome starts popping up, and he's like, Shana, all you're doing is trying to help people, you know? And you and I, you know, it's all we're doing is trying to wake people up to the truth and the love that they are, right? There's nothing wrong with that. And there shouldn't be any reason we need to explain or excuse them.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me about this today.
Totally. You're welcome.
Thank you so much for listening to my podcast. If you loved this episode, please consider leaving a review. If you're listening on YouTube, don't forget to hit that like button and subscribe so we don't lose each other. And just share the link with somebody who can appreciate this message. Blessings to you all, and I hope to catch you on my next episode.